Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We're back with our roundtable this week to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. Joining us today are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many hats is a senior advisor to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Iron Mike, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome back. Mackenzie did a great job last week pinch hitting to give us sort of an update on where we are on Capitol Hill. Obviously, the White House and Nancy Pelosi moving more closely to try to get a stimulus package through, obviously, Democrats, just to recap, approved their $2.2 trillion package many months ago. We've been waiting on Republicans to come aboard. We had the skinny cover your butt version that happened, whereas now we're having some actual discussions and negotiations. Bring us up to speed on where we are.
Okay. Well, first, things on the Hill have not changed much as far as conference on National Defense Authorization Act. The little four, which are the staff directors for the majority and minority, had their first meeting and things are progressing, but they still do not expect to get a final bill until December. Appropriations, same. We expect the Senate to release their bills in October. But again, we do not expect to see appropriations until December at the earliest. And my guess is that appropriations will be kicked into sometime early next year. So that brings us to where we stand with the continuing resolution. Even though there's been an agreement in principle for weeks, there is some drama around the CR. The Democrats were scheduled to vote on Tuesday afternoon on a continuing resolution. However, the Senate Republicans voiced their opposition and the White House to the CR. They said it violated their agreement because it did not include funding for the Commodity Credit Corporation, which is really farm aid, which lawmakers on both sides had wanted. And it also did not include an extension of a program which provides food to low-income children who otherwise aren't getting those meals in school. So the Democrats had to modify their CR and pass it that evening. So on the upside, there is language in the CR that extends the authorities under Section 3610 of the CARES Act, which reimburses federal contractors for sick or paid leave offered to employees who can't access federal facilities or telework during the pandemic. However, it did not put any funds in behind this authorization, so they still expect the department to find these funds internally. So now all eyes are on the Senate with their CR, and they are going to bring us down to the wire. The Democrats are very unhappy about how the Republicans are responding to the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and trying to force a Supreme Court justice down their throat before the election. So they're stalling on the CR, and they plan to vote on it right now on Wednesday, which is September 30th, which is the last possible day, and will have to be signed by the president that evening. But we do not fear a shutdown now, but they are creating some drama and bringing this right down to the wire. The next set of drama revolves around the next relief package. Now, after the tragic death of Justice Ginsburg, people felt that the relief package now was off the table. All the oxygen had been sucked out of the room. However, Pelosi has been trying to keep this alive, and she's under a lot of pressure from her moderate Democrats who feel they need to go home and show they passed something, even though they did pass a $3.4 trillion package many months ago. They still feel now that they need to do something, and Pelosi has said that she's willing to come down to $2.2 trillion. And as you mentioned during your introduction, the Republicans failed to pass, although united pretty much around, about a $600 billion package about 2 weeks ago. Right now, the Republicans were looking to put a bill on the floor that would extend the Paycheck Protection Program, because that program expired at the end of September, and there is some unused funds. And many of these moderate Democrats are now going to come on board or threaten to come on board a what's called a discharge petition, which would align them with Republicans. So the Republicans would, if they all signed it, it would force this bill to come to the floor and prevent the speaker from preventing it from coming to the floor. And all they would need are 20 signatures from Democrats. So that is trying now to force the Democrats' hand, where Pelosi has now agreed that she is going to bring a stimulus package to the floor next week at $2.2 trillion. She has instructed her committee chairman to draft legislation. So this way, her folks will have something they say they have voted on. But Mnuchin has come out pretty much saying that that number is too high and that we're still stuck. The White House number is $1.5 trillion. Looks like the Democrat bill will be $2.2 trillion. And once the Senate passes their CR on Wednesday, they're going to pull stakes and go home. So I think the chances of a relief package prior to the election are very, very slim.
So what do regular folks do, and what's the political repercussion of that?
Well, I think the political repercussion, one, is the blame game, that they'll blame both sides. And I think that we'll see some more executive orders from the president to make it seem that he is addressing this situation and trying to improve it. Now, look, I mean, the Senate is going to have to come back if they do vote on a Supreme Court justice prior to the election. So I assume that they will continue to hold out hope.
They're definitely going to do that.
Well, that's their plan, yes. So there is that. I think they can continue to hold out some sense of hope that if they're back, the House would have to come back for a package if they're able to come to an agreement. But I think with every passing day, coming to terms on this package is going to be very, very difficult. And I think this is something that may not even end up being dealt with until next year, depending on what happens with the election. I think the hopes of getting something done during the lame duck, if Biden is going to win the election, also becomes much, much harder to do.
I think it's going to be, it's really, really interesting to watch the political strategy on this, right? Because I think Democrats are trying to reset and say, hey, look, we're engaging again. We were prepared to do this. And it's really, really interesting how Joe Biden is staying sort of quiet on whether the filibuster goes away or whether there will be court packing, right? I mean, two things which Republicans are sort of inferring, Democrats are suggesting, but you see that the decider is not saying anything about it in a very, very clever fashion, so that he doesn't give ammunition to the other side to sort of mobilize on it, which I think, you know, if they're smart, they'll stick to that strategy. Byron, from a macroeconomic perspective, right? I mean, you've been tracking, we've got cases that are rising, obviously, in Europe. There's a lot of concern that cases are going to really dramatically expand in the fall. We're already seeing a rise in cases because folks have been kind of out and about more, right? I mean, taking the nice fall weather to sort of get out. You know, things have been slowing down. People look at these statistics and think, you know, they do get emboldened. And I, you know, have a friend whose daughter, a young daughter, was inflicted with the virus. And then other people are being similarly surprised by this. You know, is this enough? What are the implications for not doing something from an economic perspective? Because there are worries on the Hill that the Fed has done too much to buoy markets, essentially making it sort of a risk-free environment for everybody that doesn't actually mirror the economic circumstance. And we've seen some, you know, movement in the market on it.
Well, that's it.
I mean, what's your sense on the impact?
A couple of different thoughts here. First, the Fed continues to call for fiscal, you know, there's got to be a fiscal role to play in all this too. The Fed just can't carry this burden by itself. Yes, cases have started to spike again. You know, I've got a daughter in Paris, so it's kind of interesting, you know, to hear what's going on the ground there. I think, you know, as far as the unemployment numbers, you know, still remain high, and there are going to be other cliffs that start to emerge this fall that could have repercussions in terms of where some of these benefits, unemployment benefits, finally hit a cliff. And I think that, you know, the market this year, I mean, this past week, you know, you saw some certainly volatility in the European markets that spilled over into U.S. markets. I wouldn't say that Wall Street has thrown a temper tantrum yet, but I believe Goldman Sachs had reduced their fourth quarter GDP estimate considerably. I can't speak for some of the other brokerage firms, but, you know, the sense is, hey, if Washington doesn't do something here, there are going to be impacts that are going to ripple through the financial markets. And having, you know, Historically, October has been a perilous time for markets in general. So it could be, you know, that the markets throw a big enough temper tantrum in October that it might get DC's attention on this as well. But, you know, to Michael's point, I mean, there's an awful lot going on. This is the middle of, an election as well. The idea of, you know, Congress kind of all coming back to Washington when a lot of these people are in the midst of reelection campaigns is going to be a new twist here that I don't think we've really been here before. So a lot of uncharted territory.
Hey, Vago, can I give you a slightly orthogonal perspective?
Please.
My grandson goes to the University of Maryland. He just came down with it. He's a strong kid, and in 10 days he'll be fine, and he thinks he'll be immune. But the problem really is that until he and all the friends at the university who've all come down with it get tested and realize that they're okay, they're spreading it to other people. And I think the president's push on the Big Ten and the Pac-12 to reopen their seasons, and you're now going to get thousands of people possibly at some of these stadiums, you're going to see another spike. And then the question is going to be, okay, do you blame the president? Democrats will certainly do that. Or what happens and how does that impact the economy if you get a significant spike? Because you're talking about 23 big schools or 24, I forget how many are in the Big Ten now, it's more than 10, which have huge stadiums. And if they fill them even to a quarter capacity, that's 25,000 every Saturday.
It's utterly fascinating and I think utterly predictable to see what happens. Right? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, report on your fellow students. Students don't snitch on one another. They're not going to do that, nor are they going to be able to stay away from one another in a you know, social collegiate environment. Gordon and Mackenzie, anything to add in terms of the sort of political budgetary, Gordon, to use your kabuki dance, metaphor here, you know, in all of these, I do see some kabuki dancing, but you know, any points you guys want to make on the sort of broader overall financial political picture?
Well, as usual, I am shocked to learn there's politics going on in this joint, something that I have been saying for weeks. The kabuki right now about the money, and the kabuki they aren't going to do is to set aside this business of funding the government. We're not going to closing the government, not going to happen. No, nobody's interested to do that. So we pushed that off until December. And that's entirely predictable, entirely to be expected. I'm kind of like Michael. I don't expect a big COVID deal before the election, and putting a large package and a small package together on the table and saying, you know, who's going to move first, I don't think is going to pass something. There is a calculus of political advantage being made on both sides here, that the Democrats, in finger pointing, typically the Democrats can be blamed for not passing something, not being reasonable. The Republicans can be blamed for short-shirting state and local governments. And it's all pouring into the messaging departments of campaigners at the federal and state level. That's what's going on here. So I just don't expect the politics to do anything but overwhelm any capable legislative process.
Byron, why don't you lead us off on the conversation on the Washington Post story? Obviously, it got a lot of attention. The accusation or the suggestion being that the Pentagon misused the Defense Production Act and more specifically, the Paycheck Protection Program for $1 billion that went to a uniform maker. DOD's side of this story is, look, I mean, we have to preserve the supply chain across the base. And a lot of these companies do, especially smaller companies, do a lot of things that are very important to us over the grand scheme of things. But at the same time could play into the perception of a Pentagon that's sort of out of touch and disconnected, right? I mean, we talked a little bit about this before the show began of the $600 toilet seat. Clearly this doesn't appear to be that kind of a case. Talk to us about the story. What does it mean? Michael, want to get your sense and then kind of go along the line as well, because this is the kind of thing that in the absence of sort of a clear explanation takes on kind of a mind of its own, or reality of its own, or perception of its own.
You're right, Fago. This isn't, we're not back to the 1983, 1984 stories that emanated from, I think, from a House Oversight Committee hearing on initially it was $435 hammer, and then it got to be a $600 hammer. That's a whole story in and of its own right. I think a lot of it was misconstrued and overblown. But, you know, the perception was, oh, well, the DOD is being wasteful. I think in this case, it's not so much waste as much as, you know, did they use the funds that were appropriated to them for the purposes for which they are intended. And, you know, I think the intent was that was going to be more for PPE. And instead, you know, you saw a whole range of allocations or funding for aircraft engine parts, satellite parts. You mentioned the Army, the uniform company, I think it was the American Woolen Company that got some money for this. And you kind of go, well, you know, is that really a priority here? But I think hopefully, you know, the DOD can come out and really highlight a little bit more on why some of this is a priority. I do know, you know, just in passing, it wasn't a defense contractor, but you're really starting to see the stresses and strains emerge on the industrial base. It's well below the publicly traded companies, but there was a company called Impressa Aerospace that was a 737 MAX supplier that that announced they were filing Chapter 11 this week. So I think I get the bigger debate, and I'll leave it to Mackenzie or Michael or Dove or Gordon to comment. I don't think it's going to be critical or emerge as an election year issue. I think, frankly, a hearing can kind of clear the air on this. Not that there's a lot of time for a hearing, but hopefully DOD leadership could correct a little bit of this. And it, again, you know, this question of is DOD using funds that were appropriated correctly, that's going to linger.
Mackenzie, why don't you start us off on this, because you didn't have anything to add when we were doing the budgetary conversation. But what's your sense on this story and what it means?
Well, my first sense is don't let economists write defense policy stories. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. I did speak with the reporters, but wasn't quoted in it. You know, it's interesting because it's got this whiff of tremendous scandal, and there's none there, at least not by the informed. And so what I mean by that are authorizers and appropriators on Capitol Hill, OMB and Pentagon, you know, money, dollar people, everyone understood what this money was going to be used for. There was some disagreement on congressional intent behind, you know, some of it. But when there's disagreement on congressional intent, the executive branch can use the money based on how the appropriated language is written. And that's the case, and which is what they did. And further, like, that's like technically DOD didn't do anything wrong. You know, the Defense Production Act toolbox is really good, but it doesn't have a lot of money. But then shirking their duties, which is what a congressional letter accused Pentagon leaders of doing, is also not true. So they technically are doing everything fine, but then they also haven't shirked their duties. They haven't hurt the American people or the troops. So there's been billions of dollars spent on PPE through HHS appropriations, where the defense industrial base is executing some of those contracts through defense companies for this medical equipment. It's one of the ways that Ellen Lord knows that she can help the defense industrial base. And so there are different lines here. Plus, the Hill has been helping buy this medical equipment out of operations and maintenance funding lines for the force. Some of it they've spent out of, you know, the Defense Production Act generally, but really the focus has been on the operations and maintenance accounts and HHS dollars to achieve this. So again, no scandal here. It just really, but as Byron says, you know, there does need to be some clarification. I think that would be helpful for all parties to do that, including the Hill. But this story is going to die about as quick as it flared up.
Michael?
I love when I agree with
Mackenzie saying.
Well, I was going to give more of a DOD perspective, because I think Mackenzie gave a good perspective on the Hill perspective, and I think and I love it when I agree with Mackenzie and Byron, because I think they're both spot on. So I communicated with a senior DOD official the day the story came out, and they were obviously very upset about the story. And, you know, they were upset for many reasons. One, they were very sad to see a lot of Democrats, especially, piling on. They said exactly what Mackenzie just said, that the DOD complied with the law as written. But in addition, they briefed Congress every step of the way. we told them, right, and this is, you know, what I got from my friend at DOD, they told them that they would use the funds to keep the defense industrial base alive and that they would assist HHS with big contracting, which is what McKenzie referred to, because it's something that they didn't have experience with. And they would help them focus their money exclusively for medical response to COVID. But the DOD briefed Congress many times on this, right? And they worked with Democratic offices to get money to the companies that were mentioned in that article. So in their opinion, this is very poor form. They tried to work on a bipartisan basis and were disclosing every step of the way, and obviously feel that story was very unfair. And I agree with McKenzie that this will be a blip and blow over very quickly.
And Gordon?
There is not a scandal here. There is, if you will, business as usual. Here's the problem. The problem is, I think, that the department set up an expectation that was then not met. And to describe that expectation, let me do no more than to quote from Ellen Lord in April 20th in her press conference with respect to many things, including this $1 billion. From the CARES Act, we received $1 billion for DPA Title III. We anticipate receiving blanket DPA Title III approval for healthcare and medical resources to shorten the interagency process, and we are working with our interagency partners to plan and obligate. We are prioritizing, this is the money quote, we are prioritizing approximately $750 million for medical resources and $250 million for the defense industrial base, end quote. So what she set up was an expectation that this was going to be DPA-directed spending in the area of three-quarters of it, in the area of medical resources. As they evolved it, business as usual inside the Department of Defense, that evolved, and the briefings kept changing, and the briefings kept changing. But that was the expectation. The Appropriations Committee report for this, when it was initially appropriated, described it as being largely devoted to PPE industrial capacity. In other words, they set up a set of expectations that they either didn't intend to fulfill, or as things evolved over time in the department, they did not fulfill. So when you create expectations and brief in one direction and you spend in another direction, even if legal, you have basically violated the expectations that you created initially. Business as usual inside the Pentagon will do exactly what everybody has described so far. Here's what we're concerned about. We're really concerned about the industrial base. You know, some of it may be good, maybe not good. Rolls-Royce gets to upgrade a Mississippi plant. American Woolen gets uniforms. Another company gets solar systems for satellites, flight controllers for drones, space surveillance technology. Excuse me, we're a long way from $750 million for medical resources. It may be justified in terms of the industrial base and the supplier base. It creates a distinct contrast with the expectation that the department set up at the beginning, right? And that has to do a lot with internal processes in the building, which does not really like to do money for medical resources. So we've seen that in the routine effort to get rid of things like, cancer research, breast cancer research at USUHS, certain types of AIDS research. I mean, typically the department does not like to spend money on stuff that isn't the department's mission. And when you put it in the meat grinder in the Department of Defense, what comes out is not three quarters of the money for medical resources, shock, shock, but they set up a different expectation to begin with.
I think part of the sin on this is sort of like the supplemental, not to sound like Dove from even a long time ago, right? Supplemental should be for wartime purposes. It shouldn't be necessarily for buying F-35, which is a new generation of capability. Dove, let me get your sense on this as well before we move on, because time is running short and I do want to get your guys' sense.
Very briefly, I'm somewhere between Gordon and everybody else. On the one hand, I think that Ellen Lord can justifiably say, look, I didn't know that I could move some of this medical equipment from HHS to what we need as quickly as we did. And therefore, what I said in April presupposed that couldn't happen. So she could probably justify some of it that way. On the other hand, this isn't going to go away because there are enough people who want to cut the Pentagon budget and will use this as a hammer to beat up on the Pentagon. This will just be part of a larger litany. because I remember from the Weinberger days, the hammer issue didn't go away. Even if it was explained away, it didn't matter because it really was just another vehicle for trying to cut the defense budget. And the people who wanted to cut the defense budget by 10%, the House people who pushed that, will use this like they'll latch on to anything else. But I do believe that Ellen wasn't really dissimulating here. I think things turned out that they did get some of that equipment more quickly than they expected. Was it all of that equipment? Could it justify all $750 million? That I don't know. But clearly, it could justify some of it.
Byron, I know you've got to go, and you're not going to be able to stay much longer. Any last thoughts to add to this point?
No, Vago, I really got to run. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much, Byron, and we'll have you back on Monday. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Let's go to the issue of the dueling national security letters. There are about 280, if I recall memory serves correctly, about 300 generals who signed and national security figures who signed a letter in support of Donald Trump. And then there were nearly 500 general officers and former officials who signed a letter in support of Joe Biden. Some of the names on it, very, very prominent, including the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Paul Selva, and obviously Paul Zukov, former commandant of the United States Coast Guard, Jim Loy, another Coast Guard commandant, and the list obviously goes on. And this has sparked a real debate about politicization of the officer corps. And there's this sense that it's okay for political appointees, you know, whether the Dov Zakheims of the world or Gordon Adamses of the world or Bill Cohens of the world, to sign these sorts of letters. And it's a different thing entirely for flag and general officers who are expected in our form of government to be apolitical. In fact, many of them will admit to you that they have never voted for president in their entire life. H.R. McMaster, in his book, makes clear in the very, very beginning, he's never voted in a presidential election in his entire life, which I think goes for many people. What does this mean? Because the concern folks have now is that if you go, you know, two administrations past this one, that actually, for example, right, if President Trump is reelected, there is an expectation there will be a political litmus test, in part because the president has made his disdain for senior officials and senior officers in particular very clear. And Marty Dempsey, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Marty Dempsey, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, another illustrious chairman, have both made it clear that they think that this is highly problematic for folks to be doing this. What do you guys think all of this means and whether it is a positive or a negative development? Because obviously general officers and flag officers have always expressed opinions. There have been letters for decades, but this is a very, very different thing and does come across as much more politicized and so potentially more problematic. Who wants to start us off?
Vago, let me start you on this one. I signed this letter. My friend and colleague Dov Zakheim signed this letter. And I signed it because I agreed with it and because I think at this point in our politics, the election really requires people of good conscience and good mind and sound mind to get together in order to turn the election in the direction that I at least believe it ought to go. I signed this letter, right? I don't agree with everything in it, but that's fine because I generally agree with the tone of it. But I want to say that I share your reservation about general officers, flag officers being involved in this kind of politicking. They have every right to do it constitutionally. There's no, I wouldn't challenge that. It's really the norm about the political politicization of the military class. And no, it's not mea culpa because I had nothing to do with it. But part of this started as far back as Bill Clinton, the guy I worked for, pulling together Admiral Crowell and some general officer, flag officers in 1992, 1993, to support his presidential campaign and people signing up to do that, standing in front of flags, standing behind the candidate, speaking on behalf of it. And everybody since has done it. I hasten to say as well that people in some constituencies that I deal with from time to time on the more progressive end of the political spectrum believe that it's a good idea to have military, what they call validators, speak to things that they would like to achieve, because somehow it lends credibility to have somebody in uniform stand up and say, ending this nuclear program is a good idea. I have deep reservations about the whole thing. Unfortunately, I think it is now, we're past finger pointing here. This is water wherever you want it. It's either over the dam or under the bridge. That everybody is now firing back and forth in every major presidential campaign with their military validators endorsing their candidates. And I'm a Sam Huntington student, soldier in the state. American military uniforms need to stay out of politics. On active duty, they pretty much do. There are exceptions from time to time, but pretty much they do. When you get to retirement, nobody can deny them the right to speak. I do think it's unwise to have the military be the validators for candidates for office, even in retirement. That's just my personal view. I'm a little bit troubled by it, but we are, if you will, at political war. And now this has been going on both sides for, a good 25 years.
Dov Zakhan?
Well, let me pick up on that phrase Gordon just used, political war. I think the context this time around is just so different that the role of military folks in signing these letters and speaking out becomes very different as well. It's one thing where you have the traditional election campaigns. Yes, there are dirty elements, but by and large, we know how they kind of end. Somebody wins, somebody loses, the winner takes over, the loser walks out. We've got a president who's saying he may not walk out. We are terribly worried in a very serious way about a constitutional crisis. This is very, very different. And in this case, therefore, I think that Gordon's point about the military staying out, they actually could have made a much greater contribution if they would have signed letters that said, we want to preserve the constitutional process and the way we have done things since 1792. I think that would have been a far greater contribution. I don't like military people speaking at political conventions. My good friend John Allen did that at the Democratic Convention. I was very unhappy about that. But it's the context. And then you do have some people signing these letters who, frankly, did some pretty bad things when they were in uniform. And I'm thinking in particular of Jerry Boykin, who spoke in a church in uniform talking about why this should be a Christian nation. At the time, I was a Jewish Undersecretary of Defense. I'm no longer Undersecretary, but I'm still Jewish. And I complained about it. That is not what people should be doing. And again, I think what Donald Trump has brought out and what in reaction to Trump, Biden has lined up is something qualitatively different from what Bill Clinton did or George W. Bush or Barack Obama. We are in a different place. And I think the retired military could have done a lot better by pointing out that we're in a different place and we shouldn't be there.
Mackenzie?
Yeah, so I agree with your premise, Vago, that it's highly problematic. But as you noted, and others have said, this wall was broken a long time ago. It's been gradually eroding. What's interesting is that it's continuously ever higher ranking officials and more prominent people signing on. I borrow from my colleague at AEI, Dr. Corey Shockey, who's, done extensive research on civil military relations and, the U.S. military as an institution of our country and why they are so highly respected. And they're highly respected for a lot of reasons, competence, selflessness, service, et cetera. But one of them also is their perceived distance from these kinds of matters, even though, as Gordon said, it's entirely appropriate once you're retired. But that puts the institution's credibility, future credibility at risk by people's choices today to sign them. And I wonder if they are thinking about that at all. And, I understand the urgency of the moment for many people, but there will be ramifications and downstream negative effects on public perception of the U.S. military, particularly those at a senior level who have served. And not to mention just the sort of watering down. At this point, there's been so many letters and so many flag officers who've signed it. the effect is entirely negligible. No offense to any of my good friends who have signed these. You know, there was one in the Wall Street Journal last month. Before that, there was another one. There's a letter every, you know, month, it seems like. The letters do start to lose their effect when there's just a flood of them constantly.
Do you want at all, Michael, to weigh in on this?
No, I have no opinion on this at all.
I didn't think so, but I thought I should at least give you an opportunity.
Bullshit.
To discuss it. We're going to have to cut that out.
Really?
Thank you very much, Gordon. I appreciate
you're
that.
Welcome.
We're family program here, Gordon Adams. For God's sakes.
I live in that kind of family, so.
I understand. I think, alas, at the end of the day, we all do. Let's just take a brief pause. We're almost out of time. What are the critical things we want to ricochet on? Let's talk about the minority sensitivity thing, because I think that's a very, very good point and worth discussing. What else do we want to talk about?
Nothing. Keep it tight.
Yeah, I agree. I think that ought to be the last subject.
We're already not tight, so go for it.
Okay, yes, we are already not tight. I will agree with that. 3, 2, 1. Another military cultural thing. I promise the rest of our audience that we will get to a little bit, maybe more programmatic stuff, but this is the week that we're dealing with this. Although there is a 500 ship Navy question that also would be kind of interesting to get your take on. Hang on a second. 3, 2, 1. That's fucking waffle.
Hey, Vago.
Yeah.
Maybe if you could squeeze in a couple of minutes on the 500 ship Navy, there'll be a lot of.
I will. I'm gonna do that. 3, 2, 1. Two questions. Want to quickly go around the horn. One is a programmatic issue, but now that we're still on the military cultural thing, Dove, start us off on this. The Pentagon was very, very cognizant in the wake of the George Floyd incident to start to turn to race in the ranks, looking to move quickly to rename Confederate bases, lawmakers moving quickly on it. There's a 1-year study that's going to be going on, you know, that we don't want to move too quickly on that. But at the end of the day, I think their handwriting's on the wall. And we've heard from Dr. Esper. We heard from Mark Milley, an incredibly emotional message from C.Q. Brown, who's now the 22nd Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force. Khalid Wright, the former Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, talking about the Floyd incident and what it means for African Americans. And the White House now has said no unconscious racial bias training or courses. And, you know, at a time when people think, you know, are confronting the fact that as unracist as you might think yourself to be, you actually might be a little bit more colored by race than you'd like to be. What does this mean for the department that is looking always to try to be as fair and as honest and as impartial and as colorblind and increasingly sex blind or gender blind, gender blind? What does this mean when you have the White House put a stricture like this out at a time when the department is actually trying to tackle something that looks as a very valid issue for black and brown skinned Americans?
Well, the White House is playing to the proverbial base. I think their assumption, frankly, is that America is far more racist than it's willing to admit, and it wants to play to that for electoral purposes. I mean, traditionally, the military has been the pointy end of our social spear. Truman was the one who integrated the army, the military. And you have a situation here where you've got a black chief of staff of the Air Force, as you just mentioned. You've got a significant number of people of color in the military who are fighting and dying to protect our values. And then you come out with this executive order, which basically, and I'm going to quote here because it's so outrageous, it prohibits every federal agency and contractors that do business with the federal government from carrying out workplace training that suggests a person may consciously or unconsciously carry racial or sexist biases based on their own race or background, supposedly. Now, if that's the case, anybody who works, for example, at RAND or at one of the other federal think tanks cannot take a course that I was, as part of a think tank, was asked to take. And when you take that course, you do realize how unconscious we are when we're when we're thinking about race. We're not deliberately racist. We can have many, many friends of different colors and backgrounds, whatever, but there's something unconscious there. And until you realize that, you can't do anything about it. So the White House here is fundamentally undermining what's supposed to be the essence of our polity, which is that all men and women were created equal.
Look, I mean, one of the things which I find extraordinary is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the first Jewish American to lie in state under the Capitol Dome, which to me, 240 years into the Republic, is just inconceivable that that's, you know, been the case. Gordon, Mackenzie, and Michael, if you do want to weigh in on that. You know, any thoughts? Because I do want to get very quickly your guys' sense also on for this 500 ship Navy notion, which I also think is a little problematic.
I've got nothing to add.
Well, I do. I'm kind of shocked to learn that racism in America has a history, has a structure, has an economic context, that it's been institutionalized in the culture, in education, in housing, in almost every sphere of American life. And of course, the racial tensions that we've been dealing with now for several years have brought a lot of that more institutionalized process to the surface. If you want to get a sense of the history here, read a book, Shamed from the Beginning by Ibram Kendi, that will give you a very detailed and quite comprehensive history of the idea, the cultural idea of racism in America. No big surprise here, but it's extremely hard for a still in many places majority white population to countenance something going beyond individually, I'm not a racist. So that's really hard. And I have been party to a conversation privately involving a retired U.S. Army colonel whom I'm not going to name, but who is still involved in decision-making in the broader Pentagon process, who is himself African-American and has been trying to find ways to develop in the place where he is responsible for things, a more substantial training process that will go into the institutionalized cultural education, housing, economic parts of the way that this has been perpetuated in American society. And he is getting severe pushback within the military. It's not just a case of the president saying, no, you can't teach this. It's even within the military, there's a reluctance to take this on in the educational curriculum in the military. So it's a really difficult problem. And Dove is absolutely right. We put the military at the front edge of the process of dealing with race in America. That's a very good thing. But there's a hell of a lot of work still to be done.
Let's go to the 500-ship Navy reports that the department is considering that. We have roughly 290-something ships now. The plan was 355. And there's this concern of numbers for the sake of numbers that at the end of the day might not be as meaningful as the capability that you can deliver. Obviously, a question about whether to count some of these large unmanned systems against the fleet force structure. At the end of the day, you know, I know people who, you know, people in hell want ice water and they're not getting it either. Dove, I know that you advise and have advised many CNOs in the past in your role. So you're somebody intimately comfortable talking about naval strategy. And for the naval crowd who might not vote for us, let me give a Ronald Reagan-esque 600-ship Navy declaration at the end of the day.
Well, I supported the 600-ship Navy at the time. I actually was in the White House when the president said that he supported it, which is a lot more important than my support. But I think we're in a different place. I don't know if 500 ships is – I don't know that there's a number. I think that's really what's going to come out of this study. 355 is a decent number because you're at 290 now. It could be 400 as well. The real issue is the one you just mentioned. How do you count ships that you didn't count before, either because you didn't count them or more accurately because they didn't exist, unmanned ships? And I think where the Pentagon is going to come out, where OSD will come out, and where the Navy will perhaps reluctantly and some cases, but I think the more enlightened leaders of the Navy will recognize is, yeah, you count these unmanned ships. One reason being, you're really going to scare the bejesus out of the Chinese once you do that. And once you move to that, will we go down to 8 carriers, 9 carriers? I don't know. Will the number of carriers go down? Probably. Will we use amphibs as carriers since we can fly F-35s off them? Probably. I think if you're sitting in Beijing, you'll still see a large number of ships, relatively large, that carry F-35s that you're not sure you know how to deal with, plus these other ships. And so with the emphasis being on Asia, which it is and which it will be, because that's where the Navy plays, and with the ability to have these unmanned ships that will be able to pack offensive power as well as other things like communications and reconnaissance and so on, I think the Navy will finally move away from 70 years of aircraft carriers, and you won't need a Billy Mitchell to force them to do it.
Mackenzie?
Right. This spring, Secretary Esper essentially said 435 ship Navy is the new 355 ship Navy. So, you know, a lot of the bulk of the meat of this is based on things he's been advertising for half of a year now. The only question is really about the carrier, as Dev was just highlighting. The Hill, though, is taking this as, you know, people playing in fleet architecture that don't understand it. And by the way, it all won't matter if you don't have the engineering capabilities to realize this new plan, which The Hill believes pretty strongly right now the Navy does not, although they don't believe this is coming from the Navy. And that's part of the issue. So this is something that I don't think will be decided until the next this time next year, whatever the administration is, Trump 2 or Biden, it's going to be an answer for a new team. So all of this hand-wringing by Esper, I just wonder what it's for.
Gordon, anything to add? And then Michael, if you want to add anything before we wrap up for the week.
Yeah, I guess the simplest thing I could say is ain't going to happen. And the reason I say that comes from the budgetary side. All the fancy dreaming about what these ships are going to be and how much they're going to cost is just that, fancy dreaming. But the document that they were basing this off of back earlier this year described the whole exercise as budget informed. Well, I found that a very interesting euphemism, budget informed. No, it will be budgetarily constrained, because it always is. That's the way it goes. And it will be, especially if you're simply replacing heavy carriers with light carriers, unmanned submarines for manned submarines. You're basically keeping the same architecture in technologies, the cost of which is hard to predict. And as they said in that original document, if you're holding operations and sustainment funding steady while you're doing this construction program, something that almost never happens in the Department of Defense, then you're really saying this is in budgetary la-la land. It is not going to happen.
One thing about this OSD program, this is coming out of a Republican OSD. And so if Biden wins, I think they're going to push this even harder. And if Trump wins, this is where they've laid out the course for the next few years. Now, you're probably right that they're going to have to figure out the money. But, one other thing they're talking about is, and this I was told by somebody very senior, the Army is not going to like the new budget. They're going to take money out.
No kidding. Yeah.
And so that's where the money's going to come from. And, they believe that they can build these unmanned ships, a whole bunch of them, for the cost of a carrier, which is probably true. I mean, you're talking $15 billion and up. And so this may not be as blue sky as perhaps some people think.
Well, we could argue about that at great length. I do believe it's blue sky, and the constraints will be real in terms of the top line, and they're not going to be able to steal as much from the Army as they'd like to steal from the Army. And, the ONS costs are going to go up and not hold steady. And so there's a whole bunch of budgetary practices and history here that says ain't going to happen to me.
Michael, last word before we part for the week.
Sure. Quickly, I think, you know, your point was well taken earlier, Vago. Is this numbers for numbers' sake? I mean, that's something that's resonating a lot on the Hill lately, especially when we talk about the top line for defense. It's not about the number; it's about the capability. So, what are we getting for this? And I think what this is starting to create is a little bit of panic among the defense industry as to if top lines are going to remain flat and we're going to put more money into shipbuilding, what accounts are going to suffer as a result? Where's that money going to come from? But I also need to be careful what I say on this, since I do represent two shipbuilders. I think we should build 1,000 ships.
I'm sure a lot of people heard it here. Yes, you said it. You heard it here. Iron Mike skating out on the ice with everybody. Thanks very much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. And look forward to having you guys back on again next week. Thanks very much. Thoughtful conversation as always.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir, and thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.